come up here when I tell her to read something.
Okay.
Tell her. I'll yell when I need it. Am I all wired up? I want to take three steps this morning. The first one will be some general comments upon the history of this institute, which I hope will be illuminating for the second, in which I want to make some comments about how theologically I understand the meaning of your title, Fear-Filled Time. And then the third step will be to distribute among you a one-page text from modern literature, in the analysis of which I want to make concrete what I try to lay on the table during the first two steps. So number one, as I heard that succinct and I think necessary little speech that we just heard about the history and the various fortunes of this outfit, I recalled with some glad memories and with hope for the future the remarkable, almost Machiavellian deftness with which certain figures have navigated this little ship through the troubled waters of Lutheran idiosyncrasies. We have our problems, and we have our cussedness and our peculiarities, but somehow with remarkable skill and dedication, a group of people, and Miss Lutzi among them, have simply kept this craft headed in the right direction amid all the perils and temptations of this life, as the prayer book says, and they've brought us, if not to safe harbor, at least to another tack on the course. During the period of worship this morning, in speaking of the doctrine of the Holy Trinity and the festival celebrating that doctrine, I found myself moving in my own memory into the real point I want to make in my 2 days with you. That is the relation between what's happening to language and speech and the presence of that fear, that sense of impending catastrophe, which is part of the culture in the Western, in fact, the whole world. We usually don't think of anything so insubstantial as language and speech and the nature of language as being an object of either fear or of affection. And it was during the morning worship that I made certain recollections which I think can give me a well-lubricated way to enter into the very substantial text I want you to deal with this morning. One of my earliest theological, in fact, my earliest memories, has to do with the festival of the Holy Trinity. When I was a little kid in the church of which my father was pastor in Southern Ohio, I recall that it was an old general council church, a very conservative bent, and the symbols, great symbols of the church, were in the windows, four bays on each side. And during certain moments of incomprehensibility in my father's preaching for a child, I've sat there and sort of analytically took those symbols apart, wondering why this bird head down was plunging toward the bottom of the window, and other symbols. And one memorable one was a triangle. And in one it said, Deus Filius Spiritus, at the corner of the triangle. On the very inside was, not Deus, but Pater, Filius, Spiritus. Then in the center of the triangle with lines leading in from each corner was the round circle with the word Deus. And then there were lines connecting each of the three corners and another line from the middle to each of the three corners. And on the line around, it said Est, Pater Est Filius, Filius Est Spiritus, Spiritus Est Pater, and so forth. The Father is the Son is the Spirit is the Spirit is the Father. Then on the interior lines, it said Non Est. God is not the Son. God is not simply the Spirit. And here in this twisted symbol of saying he is and he isn't about each of the persons of the Trinity was a kind of mathematical device in which my mind, at least, was introduced to the mystery of the Holy Trinity, that the wholeness of the Father is not incorporate in the Son. And in another sense, the Son is the fullness of the declaration, of the manifestation of the Father. The reality of the Father and the reality of the Son together do not constitute the Holy Spirit, and yet they are inseparable, functionally, from the work of the Holy Spirit. So this kind of symbolism in the church window in my youth was my first introduction into the convolutions of systematic theology, though I didn't know that at the time. Another memory that came back, which is important, I think, as we move into this text, is the way in which our memory is inextricably joined with a language of events, celebrations, remembrances. We don't remember without language, I think. Reminds me of the old statement of Dr. Bow, the one-time president of St. Olaf College. When they asked him what he thought about a certain thing, he said, "I don't know, I never made a speech about it." I mean, the reality, structure, and substance come to clarity only when you have to articulate. You propositionalize, or conceptualize, or celebrate, or at least create some kind of a verbal transmission of the reality. This power of language grows as I grow older. In one of these recollections of my approaching senility, I sometimes think of the words that fascinated me as a child. And I remember very clearly the word I used to turn over and over my tongue when I was a kid, because, as a German says, klingt so wunderlich, it sounds so great. They stand, those walls of Zion, conjubilant with song. Conjubilant, my God, what a sound. conjubilant. I wasn't just sure what it meant. I knew it meant something very big indeed. And I remember 60 years later, when I was for my first trip to Ravenna in Italy and saw the great frescoes and iconography at San Vitale, and I saw there the marvelous staring eyes of the martyrs, and on the walls of the parish church those figures in rhythmic sequences of white-robed martyrs, the sound, the word came back to me. They stand, those walls of Zion, conjubilant with song. Well, what I'm getting at, in admittedly a devious and a calculatedly devious way, is to try to lay the groundwork for the particular thing which alone I can do. I remember those heroic days of this conference when one year I and another year Marty did the whole confounded thing. We were crazy. I mean, we ought never to have attempted it. And the blessed Mrs. Lutzi, who had to type the whole thing, must recall the heroism of our effort, which confined her to labor for a full year, I think. we did the whole presentation, three periods a day for five blessed days. And I'm happy mine is a reduced schedule this time. What is the situation? What's the situation in the most broad cultural terms with which we can move into the specific content of the term fear-filled? Where are the fountains of apprehension? What are the changes and crumblings taking place whereby we use the word apprehension, fear, a kind of wondering what's next? What's going on which gives us a kind of entree into what may be the clue to our theological, homiletical, pedagogical answers whereby the gospel may be shaped to the shape of this apprehension? Unless we understand the contours of the listening, or at least the possibly hearing culture, we cannot shape a language of transmission with any clarity and precision. This is always the effort of theology and teaching and preaching. We tend, particularly in Lutheran circles, I think, to think of theology as an accumulated body of ever more precise and clarifying propositions. Certainly as an accumulation, the clarification is more dubious. Theology is never done, it's always a doing. One is not the theologian, as one is a kind of plumber with a bag full of tools. You do a job and that's done. Theology is always it's a fresh raid on the inarticulate. Always a fresh raid on the inarticulate. How shall I talk of the Holy Trinity in 1984? Think of the magnificence of the Nicene and Chalcedonian statements which our fathers hacked out 1500 years ago. Magnificent in their conceptual bigness, in their clear distinctions, in their refusal of these distinctions about the three to disguise the center in the one. How beautifully they did this. The decision to do it differently had better rest upon a sound basis of admiration before we start fixing it up. God from God, light from light, true God, true man. How wonderful these phrases are. And with what skill they use the conceptual apparatus of the surrounding intellectual and common world in order to say what they wanted to say as a doxological apostrophe to God, the God of their faith. But now we must go at that again and again and again. I think it's because I came into theological work via the parish that I've always tested the usefulness of my own theological statements by their transmissibility in the sermon. Whether I could make sense of this thing to the faces that sat there on Sunday morning looking up at me. When I thought of the Holy Trinity, I had to be able to understand it for myself with the help of my tradition, old Catholic tradition, and then have to work that through in such a way as to find a language which should evoke the look of comprehension from these ordinary people who sat there on Sunday morning. Now that's one of the great accomplishments, I think, of Christian hymnody and Christian liturgy, that it boldly it boldly seizes the power of non-technical language to sort of point over its own shoulder backward, or point its finger forward to the possibilities of meaning which are fresh for every generation. Now, to our theme again, a fear-filled time. You'll excuse me if I take this existentially. I am an old duffer now. And in fact, a good deal of my own theological reflection the last 5 years has been programmatic. I work with two gerontological institutes, one at the University of Michigan and one in Southern California, in which the best brains they can find or seduce into activity are used to try to elucidate the meaning of aging. Now, as you know, there's all kinds of sociological, statistical, economic, financial, demographical kinds of studies of aging, the aging population, and the horrible problem it presents to the future and to the aging, if I might say so. But some of it is so ghastly for the reason that it is utterly banal. I spoke to a hospital medical staff the other day who asked me to come down and reflect upon these matters, and there the place is filled. The literature on aging was summarized in a New England Journal of Medicine article, the statistics of aging, in which they arrived by statistical mathematical calculations at what are called the worth of individuals. When you're aging, you are no longer productive. That's the fundamental notion. And loss of productivity is uncritically assumed to be loss of any worth. Now, that's a blunder of such magnitude that you wonder how it ever achieved any status. But it not only has a status, it is the operating principle that, and according to that statistic and the table there they had, at the age of 80, I am worth exactly $2,370. The notion of these guys without a smile of possible dubiety on the face, who were elaborating this science of gerontology, and assuming that when production is, of course, in mensurable terms, a product. When that ends, life as any value is over. And I was moved into making a violent speech, which I called the banality of the scientific method, in which I tried to make clear to them the fact that I no longer teach regularly, or I'm no longer, quote, productive, utterly dismisses the reality of the whole interior process whereby one's interior life comes to a kind of summing up, a new evaluation, an ever-fresh appropriation of the half-forgotten or the lost. That these years of thinking and speculating, conjecturing, with which my life is fuller than it's ever been because I have more time. This is, from their standpoint, worthless. Shakespeare's line about man must endure his going hence, even as his coming hither, ripeness is all. This notion of a kind of maturation into the ripeness that comes close to the mystery of total comprehension. This falls on the ears of the medical practitioners as goo-goo talk, you know. the utter evacuation of the scientific mind of anything like the mystery of mental life, which isn't purely problem-solving. This is simply an astounding event in my life. I didn't know it was as bad as it obviously is. So that later in the summer, I'm have a day at the University of Michigan, and I've been collecting a series of things to illustrate a two-hour lecture on the interior dimensions of aging. I've rifled the whole body, insofar as I can master it with my literary colleagues, the whole body of Western English verse and essay to collect the memorable verbal realizations of what it means to grow old. It is speech about the interior dimensions of aging by the aging. For those who look into the process of aging and do not wish to go gentle into that good night with Dylan Thomas or with Shakespeare and Milton and others. So, theologically, in my own way, with the kind of action appropriate to my age, I'm trying to bring to a close my theological career by coming down on this particular banality. Well, I want to lead you in a moment to a text and make the following introduction. I think the basic ground of fear is the human confrontation with structural changes. However we put those, in whatever discipline or job or worldview, when changes threaten to be structural, fear grows. By structural changes, I mean, to use an analogy, something like the difference between ripples, waves, and currents in the ocean. The culture shows ripples of constant change. I mean, the 10 best tunes in August will not be the 10 best tunes in October. These are ripples of change from country music a la Kentucky to country music a la Oklahoma. These are ripples which are really not very significant, although commercially important. Then there are waves. Waves are deeper, profounder, larger movements within a culture. I would say what we call the information explosion is a wave of our current culture, whereby the use of electronic devices and new applications of theoretical mathematics, we now can decibelize the evanescent. We can try to reduce to numbers the ineffable, or to reduce to equations a vast body of fact, so that in large general statements of a mathematical kind, we can perceive the way things are going, or what people are doing, or what group of people are doing this and that, what inventories are here and what here. It's a tremendous operation. My grandchildren are up to the neck in it. The other day, my 10-year-old grandson was over at our house, and I thought it was about time he read what, in my judgment, is one of the most thrilling boys' books ever written, Treasure Island. So I had a copy. I said, let's read that first chapter. I can't read it. You read it aloud to me. He read about halfway through, you know, the Jim Hawkins at the Admiral Benbow Inn and the coming of Billy Bones and the passing of the black spot of the buccaneers to this aging guy who had the map of Treasure Island in his sea chest. Good Lord, what a story. He got halfway through the chapter. He said, I don't understand all this old stuff. There aren't any buccaneers around any longer. I didn't take the trouble of reminding him that that statement is not true, that the buccaneers are now in the boardroom of the Continental Illinois Bank. But the interesting thing is the visual image of the cove and the quiet sea, the isolated inn, the growing tension between this obviously secretive old buccaneer, afraid that somebody was going to find him out, said absolutely no appeal to this kid, because his father 3 months ago bought him a computer, and now he's up to the neck in button pushing and creating new games of a purely theoretical kind. Well, this troubles me very deeply, not only about my grandson, who has other forms of trouble, but about what it means for the culture. The deepest, there are ripples, there are waves, and then there are deep currents in our changing culture. And I think the deepest of these currents is the fear-producing sense that the ultimate bastions and bulwarks and the footings of our sense of meaning, purpose, worth, intention, that these footings are being swept away or crumbling, or dubiety has now entered the mind about things which we thought were beyond the entrance of dubiousness or reconstruction. This is evident all over the place. I know when I preach, say on the festival of the Holy Trinity, that I cannot go to your college chapel, if you have one, or to a church which is closely related to student population. I cannot go and thunder out the old propositions of Chalcedon or Nicaea. I can evoke from some of them a kind of admiration that this old duffer still remembers his historical theology, but that's not quite the point of the sermon. The sermon is to lead to apprehension or comprehension, the opening to the Word of God, and the responding act of fidelity. That's the point. And that's just by winning their admiration, where my historical knowledge is not exactly the point of the sermon. So I'm aware I've got to wrestle over and over and over again with the mystery of God, disclosed as an ineffable mystery in an historical circumstance which was called the Son, which is surely a metaphor, because God does not biologically beget a child. When we say the Son of God, we're using metaphorical language. And then this manifestation of the ineffable in the historically concrete cannot be enclosed within that historical event by which the manifestation occurred, and therefore, although dead, it is not dead. It escapes from the historical bastion, the event of the historical Jesus in which it was manifested, and with an allure that seeps through the categories of historical change, is still the reality of God. Now, how to put that? How to put that in an age to which the categories of Hellenic logic, Hellenic cosmology and ontology, these categories were great, admirable. They pointed in the direction of never silenceable questions or efforts, but they are no longer functional for the informational mind of modernity. Not only is it a mind which is shattered by the information explosion, and just a footnote to that, the word information is very interesting. We mean by it, modernly, we mean the sheer multiplication and interconnected availability of raw facts and event and measurement and mensurability. Actually, the word information points beyond fact to the interior formation of a conceptuality appropriate to the fact that we don't mean by the word anymore. information is like the formation of the personality or the character by the spiritual revivals. But we mean by information simply the exterior accumulation and the celebration of multiple relations. Well, now that that is going on, I think a ground of our fear is that nothing that has been able to enclose as far as enclosures can take place, nothing that has in the past been able with some clarity to enclose the ineffability of God, Christ, the Spirit, the Church, none of those containers or pointers or propositional statements is safe from erosion or is quietly leaking out of the categories in which we have learned to prehend or see from afar what the meaning is. Take, for an instance, Christology. My understanding of Jesus of Nazareth, who is he? How did he understand himself? How do we get a glimpse of the single reality back of the multiple repertorial recollections called Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, the New Testament community, these incomparable witnesses, which is all fundamentally we have? This problem that bugged my youth when I was a catechetical kid. Who is Jesus? Still continues to trouble me as I totter on the edge of senility. So that whereas you might have a reasonable expectation that an old duffer would have his theological house in order, I must admit to you I have never been so utterly disorganized at a higher level. Not disorganized into unfaith, but disorganized because of the knowledge that the faith has got, with worn out tools, to use Kipling's phrase, to do the old job over and over and over again. I am no longer fit to teach theology. Because to teach theology in the onrushing years, one has got to have his antennae out for the signification of multiple events, ripples, waves, and deep currents in the culture, in scholarship, and the old, by definition, cannot keep that forever sensitive, so that I can recollect, I hope, fruitfully about what theology must do, but I cannot do it any longer, not responsibly. Now, I want, if Gracia Grendel would be so kind to come up here and read these lines as I call upon her to do it. You got a chair, dear? You got it?
Yes.
You know this piece.
Oh, yes.
I know it pretty well, but I may ask you to read a line ahead of me.
Okay.
Now, here, I want these passed out. I got enough copies, and after you get a hold of it, will someone distribute these? Then I will tell you why I choose this particular piece. What time is it, Peter?
I don't know.
How are we doing for time?
10:32.
And I have till what?
10:10.
I have till 10:30. Pretty far?
Yeah.
Do you ever work with this?
Oh, yes. I love this one.
Okay. Let me introduce this particular text, which I want to go through line by line. In the field of biblical studies, theology, everything we're concerned with in our ministry, the big issue at the moment is, and for some moments past, has been hermeneutics. That is, how to understand and interpret the text. The great figures in this inquiry, Hans-Georg Gadamer, begun and a problem originally, not originally, but powerfully stated by Heidegger, the current work of Paul Ricoeur, the theological work of Tracy at the University of Chicago, and Sally McFaig at Vanderbilt. There's a whole generation of scholars trying to answer this question. How does an articulated event of past time cover the distance between its creation, invention, articulation, actualization in some form? How does that act of transmission carry, thrust its reality beyond its time into the future? And what are the problems that stand in the way of reading a past thing and asking, from my situation, which is other than that of the writer, what the thing means? Let me use an illustration. When Shakespeare writes a little song, which even Shakespeare experts feel is kind of dramatic, out of place, as if Shakespeare, as if the old boy felt a good song coming on and had to stuff it in somehow. He did it, and it's not quite clear how it fits the motion of the play, but there's no anthology that doesn't have it. Full fathom five, their father lies, of his bones are coral made. These are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that remains but to suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Now, what the hell is he talking about? The obvious flat-footed occasion is a young person lamenting the death of a father. But nothing that remains but to suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. That little phrase has taken from Shakespeare's song, taken upon itself a life of its own. And suffering a sea change is a phrase now used by philosophers of history, by phenomenologists, by psychologists, by poets, to indicate that awesome accumulation, that interior history of transformation, which all history knows. You recall some years ago they dug up, I think, in the harbor of one of the Norwegian cities, a Viking ship which had been there for centuries. And when they brought the saltwater preserved skeleton to the surface, the old members of the hull were embarnacled, as it were, with all the sparkling, jewel-like encrustments of sea life. And then this phrase came back to me, a sea change. The immersion in the ancient sea causes things to go from plain wooden members to jewel-like things. Think how little accidents of the past have taken on a vast symbolical and meaning-laden character far beyond their original structure. Even maybe no structure at all. Take the great French epic, the Roman de la Rose, and Roland. Yeah. The Song of Roland. Well, they're purely legendary. And yet these legendary figures with a very slight historical basis have become immense vessels in which to carry forth the interior historical sensibility of a whole people. Beowulf, the demon of which is your name, isn't it, Grendel? Beowulf has served the English-speaking world in the same way. Well, nothing remains but to suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Now, when the Gospel of John says, He is the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Can this ancient symbol of Lux, Mazda, Fos, light, can that enduring and perduring symbol, how does an historical personality take upon itself the somehow concretize the ineffability of the suggested symbol, light, in John, light, life, truth. These three become concretized within the confines of an historically described personality. So when we, standing here, look at a text from back there, what has happened to the development of what we call Verstehung, understanding, comprehension, between then and here? Well, let me tell you one awesome thing that's happened in the 20th century. The old meaning of the word understanding, and hence that is the reduction of the meaning of understanding to empirical verifiability and falsifiability in statements in the 20th century philosophy, has meant an enormous reduction in what is meaningful. In other words, if a thing purporting to have meaning cannot be affirmed, proposed for thought in such a way as to meet empirical tests of verification, it is, quote, a meaningless statement. To say that God is love is, according to analytical philosophy and some schools of it, a meaningless statement, because it can be neither proved nor disproved. You may believe it as an emotive possibility of childish apprehensions or wishes, desires, or grown-up ontological speculations, but you can't prove it, nor that neither can you disprove it. So that it is, to quote the empiricists in the modern sciences, it is a meaningless statement. For instance, when you ask what Paul Tillich used to say, the ultimate question, why is there something rather than nothing? And you can't help asking it. No matter whether you are a tremendous speculative thinker or a little child, the question is inescapable. Why can you think of nothing? It is cerebrally impossible to think of nothing, because you're trying to think of nothing with something. And at least there's the thinking about with, so that it's a fine fix we're in. And when I talk to a cosmologist, you know, who is, say, an apostle of the Big Bang school, and I say, well, your description of nature simply begins at a certain point beyond which you don't go and you forbid me to go. And if I say, well, this enormous energetic focal point which exploded into the cosmos, it is something, isn't it? Well, he said, that's a meaningless speculation. Well, in terms of an empirical ability to know beyond, he's quite right. As one of the cosmologists, Percy Bridgman, says, we can't get beyond the Big Bang because the beyondness was destroyed in the event. That's a brain-shattering proposition. But that does not solve the question of looking for meanings, purposes, intentions. I have worked out in my life a fundamental principle that if a thing is neither soluble nor dismissible, it must be important. And most of the great problems of life are neither soluble nor unsilenceable or silenceable. The problem of truth, intention, purpose, direction, benevolence or malevolence as ontologically basic.
like Melville's question, is the great whale smiling at me or waiting for me? Well, now all of this, the problem of how to interpret a thing which is mute, nature, history, the whole accumulated human reflection, as before contemporary questions of reconstructing crumbling foundations all over again, is mute. How do we go about it? I have picked a text from Wallace Stevens, a 20th century poet. There are other people here who know more poetry than I do.